A Place for Us is a special kind of podcast that came out of a desire on my part to create a special place. One might even call it a sacred place, where I could share deep thoughts or talk about things that are really bugging me or that I'm very passionate about, all with the intention of bringing my passion and my heart and my vulnerability to the airwaves and to invite others to make it their place, to connect with me, to share their stories. I thought I'd be doing many more of them, but then COVID hit and I actually didn't feel like it, so I didn't, and that's the joy of this. COVID hit, lots of things changed, and I kind of went silent on A Place for Us for a bit, but now here we are. This episode of A Place for Us is all about love, about despair, about hope, about strength, and about what happens to family relationships when a phone call comes that brings life to a grinding halt. At its core, this is also a story of resiliency, humanity, and health. To me, the story you're about to hear is illustrative of the universal connection we all have as human beings on the planet and how essential our own health is to being able to take care of the health of the planet, which you know is a cause near and dear to my heart. And it makes it abundantly clear that none of us are immune to the human experience of a health crisis. What you're going to hear is an amazing story about humanity, about three phenomenal women, a mother and her two daughters, all of whom are in the healthcare profession and who found out loudly and clearly that when it comes to bad news, health does not discriminate. One of them is the president and CEO of a nationally recognized and ever-expanding integrated healthcare delivery system. Another is a child life specialist at a children's hospital and a blood cancer survivor. And yet another is an occupational therapist serving adolescents and adults with chronic conditions. It's almost too much to believe. So a warm welcome to each of you. Deep gratitude that you're willing to share this journey with me and with others. And I'm honored to know that people who listen will have quite a bit to take away. Lots to think about and maybe even help them through whatever might be going on in their lives. So please join me in welcoming Judy Rich. That would be the president and CEO of the ever-expanding healthcare integrated healthcare delivery system, and Amanda. And you know, Amanda, I put your last name on this, but you're Amanda Rich to me. So what is your last name? I missed that one.
It's Toms, Amanda. That's Toms.
Right. Amanda Toms. And she is the child life specialist at the Children's Hospital in Cincinnati. And then Emily Rich is the never-ending, I mean, it's unbelievable to me that you are an occupational therapist working with adolescents and adults with chronic conditions. So I don't know how that better prepared any of you, but away we go. So thanks, all three of you, for being here. So Judy, I'm a mom, and I figured, hey, I'm starting with the mom, because let's start with you and how your life came to a grinding halt on New Year's Day in 2018. What happened?
I received a phone call from Amanda's husband, Gene, telling me that she was in the hospital and she had a sudden inability to use her legs. So in short, she was paralyzed. And in addition to her two legs not working, her left arm was also not functional. So I hopped on a plane, got to Cincinnati as fast as I could. And within just a couple of hours of arriving, we heard the news that Amanda had blood cancer, multiple myeloma.
So happy New Year. I mean, when you first told me that, it was like, okay, life will never be the same. Stops you in your tracks. And you're a healthcare professional, and there's not a lot that you can do about it at this point. So Amanda, talk us through what happened. Like, it's your life. You're going along in a direction. Tell us about what happened and what you feel like you lost that day.
It was very dramatic. I had been having some pain in my left arm, but we couldn't figure out what it was. And the sudden tingling in my legs, and then by the next morning, inability to walk was completely devastating. Losing my independence overnight. I worked 40 hours a week at a job that I loved, and all of a sudden I couldn't even take care of myself and get up to go to the bathroom. So it was pretty devastating, and just the unknowns of what is this going to be like with, one, losing my ability to walk and use my left arm, and then, two, having a blood cancer with no cure.
Yeah, there's that. It's like, take a deep breath. And we're going to go into that a little bit more as well. And Emily, here you are, a sister and a daughter. What was happening for you in those weeks and months while it was all going on? How are things evolving in your life?
Yeah, it was really hard to process. And I don't know that I processed much in that first month or really even 2 months. But I was actually studying for my boards to become an occupational therapist. And so I was this really optimistic, young, maybe naive person who was like, oh, she's going to walk again, or we're going to figure everything out, you know, just kind of this probably too optimistic person in the picture. But it was, yeah, I don't know that I really processed much in those early days.
Yeah, I think it's called shock.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things, not knowing. And, you know, Amanda, you lost your legs and feeling in your arm and your job. And that's a whole bunch of stuff. Everything that you knew was changed. So part of what I want to know, what happened inside of you that said, yeah, you just think I'm not going to walk? You are one tough cookie. I read a lot about you, and you are one tough cookie. So what kicked in that said, that's really not going to be me?
You know, I've been asked this question a lot, and I don't have a great answer. I have always considered myself a positive person, and I think a lot of that comes from my mother, and she is a very happy, positive person. And so I think I looked at this kind of huge loss as, okay, I need to focus on one piece of this. And I kind of pushed the cancer to the side, and I said, I'm going to walk again. And that became just the driving force for everything. And I think it was so many people around me that were pushing me and encouraging me. We had people from all over the country, you know, messaging and letting me know that they were praying for me every day. I got so many letters, and I had this fun daily excitement when I would get mail at the hospital, and I would sing this little song that I made up about mail time, and I would get so excited about all the things that I received in the mail. So it was so many people pushing for me or pulling for me, and just deciding that I was going to do this. It was hard. It was very hard. But I felt like I still had so much life left to live, and I wanted to be able to walk again.
And what I didn't know where to throw this in, and it's very personal, but it's also wonderful that your husband stayed by your side. I think that's really noteworthy, because that isn't always the case. And from what I understand, he has been there, and that makes a difference, all the support.
He has been absolutely incredible from day one with all of this. We had just gotten married 6 months before I was diagnosed. I'm 31. I'm just married my husband in this job that I love, and then this happens. So the fact that he stayed right by my side, he was my biggest cheerleader. He really was, made a world of difference.
It really, really does. I loved when I did ask the question when I talked to your mom and Emily a couple of weeks ago. So Judy, here you are, CEO, TMC. It's a big freaking job, let's be honest. So now you're in a different role. You're a mom in a healthcare situation in a very different role. And Amanda, you were at Mayo for a bit, correct?
Yes, Mayo in Arizona.
And which was like better for your mom, because she only had to drive to Phoenix instead of flying to Cincinnati. So you go from being the person in charge, and now you're the mom. Did you change a lot through all of this? How? I don't even know the answer to that.
I don't know if I changed, but I certainly adapted we made the decision early in Cincinnati. She had been in the hospital for 5 days when the doctor said she needs more specialists than I have here, and the best person in the world to treat her is in Scottsdale. So, you know, God led us to Scottsdale, Arizona, where it happened to be not far for me to go, but it was also the best place for Amanda to be treated. And the team that I work with here at TMC gave me absolute permission to focus on Amanda. And a friend in Phoenix gave me a place to stay, a little casita on their property. So I had the ability to touch base with my team here, make sure that things were okay, but spend many, many, many days with Amanda, knowing that I could be close by, I could oversee her care because I'm a nurse, and I completely trusted her with the nurses at the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, but I also wanted to be there to support her and to encourage her and to keep her safe. And that was a big adjustment for me because I'm used to being in charge. And Amanda made it very clear to me when she was still extremely ill the first couple of weeks, and truly, we didn't know if she would survive at that point. But in her sometimes very ill fog, she would look at me and say, back off. I'm an adult mom. My husband is here. And she always said it with love, Mrs. Green. But she said, clearly, you are not running this show. And so I had many moments where Amanda benched me, and I would go out into the hallway and pace. And the nurses would say, she kicked you out again. But they knew that Amanda and I had a relationship that was going to survive this. And surely it has survived this, because I have been able to watch my 31-year-old daughter stand up to the most difficult challenge that anyone could possibly face. And I've watched her do it with grace and love and strength.
There you have it. And I said to Kelly, there's no way I'm getting through this show without getting emotional, and shame on me if I do, because I want to. This is about real pain and real suffering and real family and strength. So Emily, Miss Emily, what's your role in all this? You're watching. You have your mother in the hallway kicked out by your sister. And I know it wasn't quite that harsh. And then there's you. So what are you doing in the midst of all this? And this, how do you come around and deal with this struggle and show up as love?
Yeah, it was a tricky situation. And I don't know that I would say it wasn't as harsh as it sounds. It was rocky. No, I mean, it's like...
It was.
There's so many emotions and so many, that loss of independence and that need for normality and not being around your friends and not having that purpose of work and, you know, just being going from being in a healthcare role to being a patient all the time. And so it's ironic because occupational therapists are, you know, our role is to try and get people back to doing the things that matter to them. And so I think I just tried to balance that piece of bringing normality and kind of treating Amanda like the same sister I've always had, you know, and even though she was using a wheelchair to get around, what would, normal life look like? Like painting our nails and, you know, trying to make her hair look cute since she was, you know, stuck in a bed all day kind of thing. And so I think that was an important thing. And it was, you know, me kind of putting aside that processing and that grief so that, you know, we could bring some more normality to it. And I had been a student at Mayo right before this, so I knew a lot of the staff. And there were times when I had to advocate for, a specialized custom splint or, you know, a different therapist or whatever. And it was a really weird role to be in on the other side of it, and gave me so much insight into, what it's like to be a desperate family member, you know, that kind of the quote unquote crazy family member that's like, you know, I need this. I need to advocate for my sibling for this kind of thing. So it gave me a lot of perspective.
No kidding. And I talk a lot about, in my notes, I made a lot about, you know, how you see things from a different lens. And I always picture a camera up and I'm, you know, changing it to telephoto. And you each have such a different lens to look through because you are healthcare professionals. So that had to change it. So Judy, I want to ask you about attitude, because you shared something with me about how important your attitude is in terms of healing and hope and all of that. Even as you approached the Mayo on your many trips to Phoenix, when did that like stop you in your tracks? And I think Emily helped you with that.
Well, Emily kicked me out a few times too, I have to say that. but what happened was, you know, I would drive in very early in the morning because it was wintertime and it was very dark. And Amanda had to get up and get going very early, have breakfast and get to therapy because it was all about getting her to walk again. And this was all while she was having chemotherapy and radiation therapy for her cancer. And so I would drive in every morning when it was still dark and I would see the big Mayo Clinic sign. And I told Emily one day, I am developing this horrible dread and almost anger at Mayo Clinic because it's where my daughter is and she's in pain and she's hurting. And so over time, I had developed a kind of a negative attitude toward the place that was helping her. And Emily said to me one day, because she does not mince words and she can switch roles pretty well to become the advocate for her sister. She said, perhaps, Mom, you need to stop thinking about Mayo as the place where Amanda is in pain, and you need to start thinking about it as the place where she's healing. And perhaps if you can change your attitude from one of dread to one of hope and healing, you will feel differently when you drive into that parking lot. And wow, when your kid, who's 27 years old, 26 years old, tells you something like that, it stops you in your tracks and you realize that you need to change your attitude, because if you're going to continue to help Amanda or Emily or anyone in our family, I can't look at it from a negative lens.
It's like, bam, and it's from your daughter. So I think that's pretty powerful too. And my kids can do that with me too. It's like, you're going down the wrong path, Mom. They don't say it like that, or sometimes they do. But to flip that switch a little bit had to help a lot.
It did.
And I would feel the dread. My brother was a quadriplegic. And when we had to go to the hospital, it was like, oh, awful. But then we got to the point where it was like, they're helping him. They're really helping him. So I understand that. So Amanda, this is like one of the favorite parts I want to do. It's called the what not to say part of the show, because I can tell you this. I have a friend that I mentioned to you all in the beginning that her husband is in hospice as we speak. And I don't want anyone to ever say to me, if I should outlive my husband, he lived a good life, because I will probably punch them in the face because I don't care about that. If he's not in my life, I don't want to hear that. So what are some of the things that people say to you from a place of love and caring that would be better put maybe in a different way? And I know I'm not asking you to pick on people, but this is hopefully giving people ideas about what they could say that would be more helpful than some of the things they say. Do you have a couple of examples for me?
That's a great question. I do. It actually comes from a book that I read pretty early on in my after I was diagnosed, and it's called Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. And this author named Kate Bowler puts it in a very humorous way. At the back of her book, she has a list of things not to say and then ways to support somebody going through a tough time. And Everything Happens for a Reason is one of the big ones. I don't want to hear that.
I know. Everything Happens for a Reason and Other Lies I've Loved. It cracked me up when I heard in that book. It's like, stop it.
Yeah.
Not helpful. So is it safe to say the last thing in the world you want is pity? And what you want is either empathy or sympathy. Most people can't have empathy, but what does help the most?
I think a lot of times people will, when someone's going through something tough, they'll want to help, right? And so it's the what can I do? And then the person who's struggling has to come up with something for them to do. And sometimes that's easy and it's, you know, yep, we could use a meal. But other times it is just so helpful to just come up with something yourself and say, I'm going to pick you up at, you know, for therapy on this day. I had a lot of people that jumped in to help give me rides to my physical therapy because I couldn't drive, couldn't get myself around. And that was huge. Just people saying, I'm going to help by taking you to therapy, or I'm going to bring dinner over one night, which night would be best? And just giving a very specific, here's how I'm going to help you. And that's so huge because then the person struggling doesn't have to think about it.
It's been so helpful for me to have this with some of the things going on in my life personally with friends and death and dying. And you are so right. Let me know if there's anything I can do. Empty offer. Mm-hmm. So just empty, like, yep. I say things like, now, and I learned from this. Okay, we're bringing dinner Saturday night, which in fact we did last Saturday. And then I've said to some people, I don't want to say, let me know if there's something I can do. What can I do? Is there something? Do you want me to bring dinner? Do you want me to come over and do the laundry? Which hopefully they will always say no, but I would do it. And so there are things like that. Okay, so that's what not to say. Okay.
I have a good one.
Good.
That Amanda said to me early on. People would say to Amanda and to Emily and to me, well, you know, we never know how long we have. We could get hit by a car any day.
Oh, my God. Said that. Tell me, are they still your friend?
It's common. It's common. And it's because the person who is saying that is trying to make themselves feel better by saying, oh, well, what's going on with you really isn't that bad. I mean, we all could die at any time.
Yeah. And the one which Kate Bowler got, everything happens for a reason. Well, could you please get me some notes on that? Because I'm not quite sure I've got the reason figured out. Sometimes bad stuff happens, and that's what you have to deal with. So I'm interested in each of you. I want to go back to the, you know, Judy, here you are as a mom getting thrown out of the room by both your daughters, obviously. All kidding aside, you're not the person in charge. Now you're the mom. And you're seeing it through the patient's eyes. Can you talk a little bit about the view from that lens in terms of how people affected Amanda's life every day? The caring, the professionals.
Absolutely. I saw every person who walked in the room, their body language, their smile. This was before masks, and I'm grateful for that. I saw the caring touch and the communication, telling Amanda what was going on, telling her what was coming next. And we met very few people in her 3 months at Mayo who disappointed us. But the people who disappointed us lacked the caring and the empathy that you were describing, that says, I know this is a tough time for you and I'm here to help you. How can I help you? And I had the opportunity to watch people really give of themselves to Amanda, because she became quickly loved by the staff. She was there for long enough that they got to know her very, very well. And I watched them grow into a relationship with her where they would do things at home and bring them to her. They would text her on the way in the morning and say, do you want me to pick something up for you on the way in this morning? One of her nurses made her and painted her a slide board to slide from her wheelchair into the bed or to a chair. Went home, made it out of wood, painted it pink. And you know, it's all the little things that people did that made me realize that we don't know when we're doing it how well it's going to be received, and how they didn't get thanked for everything, but it was just what they did. And then, of course, there were the people who came in who were just not connecting. They were on a different level. And I used to pray that they wouldn't be her nurses. Because
yes, what shift is this?
Yes. And if I go back to the part about my daughter telling me not to be in charge, I wanted to go to the charge nurse and say, who's on tonight? Could you tell me who's going to be her night nurse? Yes. Because, you know, I have some that I like and some that I don't. And again, to Amanda's credit, she would say to me, Mom, stay out of it. You can't manipulate people to be the people you want them to be for me. I'm a big girl. I will handle this. And she was so vulnerable that all I wanted to do was run interference. But over time, I came to trust them. I came to leave maybe an hour earlier in the evening and maybe get there a little bit later in the morning because I started to really trust that they had her and I didn't have to be the one to hold her.
I mean, it's so much responsibility to be thinking that you have that responsibility and then knowing that you just kind of have to let it go because you are not in charge. So Amanda, what about you? Were you always this, I don't want to say woman of steel, but did you always have this strength? Is this the child that you were that became the adult that you are, that you showed up like that?
I don't know.
I want to know what Emily and Judy will say too.
Yes, right. What is their perspective? No, I think so. I mean, I think I get a lot of my strength from my mother. I'll say that again. I mean, she's
quite a woman.
An incredible woman to be
yes.
the CEO of a hospital. And so I definitely think a lot of that is her. And I've always been independent and wanted to be independent and moved to a new city at 22 and started a new job and just wanted to kind of figure things out on my own. So I do think some of that was already in me. But then I think being sick and wanting to be normal also pushed me a little bit more. I wanted to feel normal. So I wanted to be able to do things on my own as much as I could.
Right, right. So Emily, do you want to chime in? Any 2 cents, add that? I don't want to keep you out because you're sitting there smiling or grinning or coming up with what?
Yeah, I think that I don't want to speak for my mom, but I think Mom and I would have a little different perspective. More, not that Amanda was never independent or not like could do things for herself. She's always been that way. I think it's the difference between like having adversity, having any kind of medical issues. I used to joke growing up that like they ran out of good genes when they got to me because my brother and sister, who are older, both older, had the perfect health my whole life. And I have all these chronic conditions. And in fact, that was one of the first things Amanda said to me when I walked in the hospital room when I got to Mayo. Was like something along the lines of, you know, now who's got it worse or, you know, something like that. Cause it's just like ironic. So I think what my mom and I were reflecting on is just that, you know, Amanda hadn't really had to face medical stuff before. And it was like, you go from 0 to 100, right? This is like incredible, you know, not only a cancer diagnosis, but not being able to walk. And, I think that we were just incredibly impressed with how she adapted so quickly and how she rose to that challenge. And I think that a lot of what's unique about Amanda's experience, and I know that she speaks to this, is just this adolescent and young adult, kind of this AYA population, and what my mom's describing of, you know, wanting to be able to take care of her like she's a child. And she's not in that like older adult age where, you know, your child takes care of you. She's in this very much independent adult, you know, age and how unique that was in having these kind of diagnoses.
Yeah, major, major. And it's when we were talking, we had a brief conversation, everybody, to kind of go, where do we want this to go? What do we want the takeaways to be? And I think one or both of you, Emily or Judy, said, really, you don't get sick by yourself. it might have been you, Judy, when you have something like this, the whole family is impacted. So it's the person that is suffering and then all of the loved ones around them. So I thought that was very, very telling. And Amanda, what is your current health situation now? Your current health, what's going on?
So since 2018, January, which was when I was diagnosed, I have basically, I've been receiving treatment the whole time. So I've had lots of chemo, several different sessions of radiation to different parts of my body. I've had a stem cell transplant. And then most recently, and what happens is I keep kind of relapsing. I get on a treatment regimen, and then there's more cancer cells that come back. So I've never been in a remission since then, and which is also pretty typical of myeloma. There isn't really a true remission. But most recently, they found a new mass that I got radiation for. But then the FDA recently approved a new treatment, and this is a treatment that I have been hearing about since my diagnosis. It's the future of cancer treatment right now, and it's called CAR T cell therapy. And I am in the process of receiving CAR T treatment, and I will get these T cells back on June 7th. So we're getting close to this new chapter with this new advancement in treatment.
So it's a perfect segue. You couldn't have set it up better because you have been nominated for Woman of the Year by the Lymphoma and Leukemia Society. And you said a new therapy. Why is it so important to support this organization? I actually know a lot about it because with the Chapman Cares team, we worked with them and did their Light Up the Night walk many times. So tell us, give us your pitch for why it's so important, because you're a real person benefiting from research.
I am, yes. The Leukemia Lymphoma Society is a phenomenal organization. We got involved with them pretty early on, and they so much of their money raised goes directly to research, and that's what's so incredible about them. A lot of the drugs that I've already taken, and then this new CAR T cell therapy, the money that Leukemia Lymphoma Society puts towards research helps to develop these drugs that I have been taking. And there's so many drugs that have recently been approved because of this research. I've also been a recipient of the Leukemia Lymphoma Society's copay assistance program. As you can imagine, the drugs for cancer are very expensive. And so they have a wonderful program where they will help to pay for some of the co-pays for these treatments. And then they also have a lot of amazing support programs. So they have online programs where you can be paired up with someone, kind of like a mentorship. They have various resources for someone who's newly diagnosed that are beneficial. They have a lot of educational sessions. And so they're just an incredible organization that really works to take care of the whole family. Like you were talking about, it is the entire family. So they have support for caregivers, for children of adult patients, for everybody affected by cancer, and the incredible fundraising that they do. That money goes towards drugs that are really keeping me alive right now.
And one of the things that amazes me is a lot of their board members, why it's such a strong organization here in Tucson, it's because of someone in their life being affected by it. So they do want to have hope, and they do want to get involved, and they do want to raise money, and it's for the research. It was so powerful when your mom and Emily shared that with me. It's like, my daughter's alive today, my sister's alive today, because of the innovation and the discovery of new drugs. So I kind of got lost in that thought a little bit. And I want to ask each of you, Amanda, you now live with a chronic illness. And from what I understand, there won't be a cure. But I can tell you, I have a friend who has treatment and he's doing so well. And it's like 6 years of really good health. And he's a lot older than you are. And I would like to ask each of you, how do you live with a chronic illness or with someone you love who has a chronic illness? So do you want to start, Amanda, since you are the one living with it every day?
Sure, I can start. You know, I think that's something that I am figuring out as I go.
Right, right. Yes, it's a journey. It is.
For me, getting to walk again, pushing through those early couple of years of lots of therapy and getting to walk, and then actually being able to go back to work was huge for me. Being able to work in a field that I love. I absolutely love working with children and families at the hospital. And that was something that that really helps to push me. And I have this new sense of enjoyment of life now because I know how fleeting it is. And I kind of am, the girls at work kind of joke a little bit because I'm always so excited at work and I'm like, oh, isn't this great? because I do love it so much. And so being able to get back to the things, the normal life things that we take for granted has been huge. And then I have some different ways that I cope with tough things. And one of those is yoga. I got very involved with yoga through a local cancer support community. And I have a great community there. And then I also have a young adult cancer support group that I attend. And so that's been some neat relationships there because we understand what each other are going through like no one else does. So that's been neat.
And probably nobody ever says to you, God only gives you what you can. Nobody better ever
that's
say
another
that to
one
me. That's another one. Please don't say that to me. That does not spark joy in my heart. So Emily, what about you? What do you have to say hearing this from your sister dealing with a family member that has, you know, you have a lot of health issues yourself, but this is a really serious, life-threatening chronic illness? What do you want to say?
Yeah, I think finding those ways to be optimistic yet have that reality too. And so like just finding that balance, I think, of not getting stuck in, the worst case scenario and learning how to communicate with family and friends about what you need and what is and isn't helpful, you know, as we've been saying those kind of words. But also, I know, you know, there's times when there's good news and it's like, you know, you can celebrate that to a certain level, but also there's that reality in there. And so I think communication, I know Amanda's found a lot of really great support. And I think that piece of connecting with people who understand what you're going through is so huge. And being able to express like the grief and the realities that you might not be able to share with family members. Just like finding that balance of, you know, living life and finding that purpose. I know when Amanda went back to work, it was just such a big deal to have that like meaning and purpose in her life. So I think she's just done an incredible job of finding that balance.
So I'm sitting here as a mother, Ms. Judy Rich, and I'm wondering if you're sitting there with a full heart, a big warm grin on your face, because they're your daughters and look at them. So here's where I lose it, guys. What are you sitting there feeling, Judy? Bring this on back for me.
Well, I think what I want to say, because it was part of the question that you asked a moment ago, was how did I get kind of through this and to where I am today? And I want to tell people that as a leader of many, many people and someone who's considered to be strong, I really struggled with my public persona after Amanda's cancer diagnosis. My team here knew that I was gone a lot to be with her. And when I first came back and started meeting with my team again, I struggled with how much to share, how open to be, whether or not I should cry in front of them, how much of my heart to show.
Right.
And I found such a peace when I started to talk about it. Not a lot, because I needed to keep it in a certain place. But the decision that I made about 4 months into this was to seek help and get a therapist. Never in my life had I had therapy before. I probably was quite proud of the fact that I had gotten where I have been in my life without needing therapy. Boy, what a knockdown revelation when I started to see a therapist and worked through my PTSD, which is exactly what it was, my nightmares, the things that I couldn't get out of my head that happened early on when Amanda was first diagnosed, and accepting my need for therapy so that I could be there for Amanda. And I have to say that the sister, Emily, who was very much affected by Amanda's diagnosis, actually had to pull me up one day after about a year and say, "Enough of this, Mom. There's good things happening for Amanda, and you need to see the good things." She was my constant reminder that there's joy in this and there's not constant pain. So it's been an incredible journey for me personally. I'm not a young person. I'm getting old, and I have learned so much through this journey about trusting and about needing and saying I needed help, accessing that help, and then trusting the people that I love and the people that I work with every day to be a part of my journey.
So just the fact, this came about because Julia sent me a message on Facebook or something, or texted me and said, "I really think you should do a show about this." And I was like, on it. It's so important to me, especially there's a lot more grieving and loss and pain and chronic illness with COVID. I mean, one of my friends who was in TMC for 2 months, her lungs are devastated, and her quality of life has changed, and she had all of that support. So I think it really matters to really push rewind and listen to what each one of these human beings have had to say. So we're coming to an end, kind of. And I wonder if this is like trick the guest question, which I never do. you might have answers or not. But what would you love, each one of you, that people can walk away with from this interview? What takeaway do you hope they have? Is it about hope, strength? What is it about that you want to say, if you remember one thing from our conversation, it's X? And I'm not going to pick on anybody. Whoever wants to speak up first gets the first spot.
Well, I will say that people have often said, "How do you get through it?" I know Amanda hears that a lot. "Oh my gosh, it sounds like it was so terrible. How do you do it?" And the answer is always, we do what we need to do for the people that we love. And we find the strength. It's there. We just don't always know that it's there until we need it.
It's really wonderful. Okay, who wants to go next?
I always think about the word advocacy and how much we use that in my journey. But you've heard each of us talk about that today kind of in different ways.
Right.
Going through a challenging medical situation, it helps to have someone else advocate for you, my mom and sister both did very well in different ways. And then I was able to advocate for myself in different moments. And I still do. I mean, I continue in my treatments to kind of figure out, okay, what's going to be best and help me get through these and advocate. Whether it's advocating for music in an MRI scan, or like my mom said, advocating for therapy when it was is when it was necessary. So I think that's all something that we need to remember to do, whether it's being able to do it for ourselves or have someone else advocate for us.
And you're speaking about reminding the caregivers to take care of themselves too, because it does happen to a family. So Emily, what do you want to chime in with there?
I think just even when something feels so huge and, you know, the numbers look bad online or, you know, it just feels impossible, we really are making huge gains and strides in research and development of new treatment interventions. And as Amanda spoke to, LLS is just funding incredible. The statistics are amazing of the drugs that didn't exist before. And so I think, you know, it's easy to see so many of fundraisers and so many things and to not really know, you know, where your money's going or what's happening. But we just, you know, the future did not look great. It looked pretty bleak when she got this diagnosis. I say we got this diagnosis because, again, it feels like the whole family does.
Yes. Yes.
But it's just been incredible to see, you know, not that you need to be overly optimistic, and but I think it's been amazing to learn about how fast things are progressing and truly just trying to keep that optimism through that.
So I've learned so much just by hearing it. I mean, all of your journeys and the way that you work together, and you never know when it's going to happen. So is there anything else that any of you want to add before I have my last words, as I call them?
Never underestimate the power of three strong women.
Oh, I love it. Oh my God, I'm doing the happy dance. Seriously. Okay. So as I said at the beginning of this conversation, this interview to me is all about love, about despair, about hope and strength, and about what happens to family relationships when a phone call comes that brings life as you know it to a grinding halt. At its core, this is also a story about resiliency, humanity, and health. I heard that in each of your responses over and over. And as for me, I am so grateful and so humbled and so touched that these remarkable, strong women were willing to share their stories, their pain, their vulnerability, and their resilience with all of us in the hopes that anyone who is listening will learn from it if and when a simple phone call changes your life, and maybe, just maybe, above all else, remind us that when someone we love is in need of support, we have some great ideas about what that looks like and what it doesn't. There are many takeaways for me, and I hope for all of you, our listeners. I'm touched and filled with gratitude that I got to be here, that I got to hear this story, to learn from it, and to remind myself how important it is to show up as love and support when someone I care about needs me to do just that. So Judy Rich, Amanda Toms, and Emily Rich, thank you so much for caring enough to share this with me and with all of our listeners with your wide and open hearts. And as always, my final thanks is to you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. So thank you, you three, and I'll be continuing to follow the journey. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, how hilarious is it? And we don't want to cut this. How hilarious is it that the dog barked at the very end? Perfect. Oh my gosh, it's so perfect. And I say to everybody, this is Mrs. Green's world. People have dogs. Get over it.
Oh my gosh.
If you want a dog-free show, tune into NPR. That'll be great. I hope that works for you. It was so perfect, you guys.
Thank you, Mrs. Green.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Thank
Thanks,
you.
Emily. Thanks, Amanda. Thanks, Judy. Thank you.